Ha Mitkayepe, I am Ogala Lakota from Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. I go by Zikato on online formats, and I am the host of Bands of Turtle Island and a co-host on the Red Nation Ziyode series. You should check that out and give money to the Red Nation. In our last episode, we heavily covered what the realization of, the actualization is probably a better word, of decolonization means, you know? But I felt like we didn't, articulate good enough how we came to those conclusions and stuff like that. Like, the only real thing we did was, tell you how to give money, you know? And that's good and all. But, like we said in that episode, I think even, giving money is just a good start. You should be doing a little bit more. And so, since that time, I've been asking myself, what can I do for the people where I live, you know? Where are their material conditions lacking? And how can I and others help them? That's probably the simplest way to start, you know? But I've also been asking myself, what does it mean to be a communist, right? You know, I had mentioned in the previous episode that there was a difference between communist revolutionaries and communist sympathizers. All too often, our worldview is justified by extreme positions of nuance that helps us cope, I guess, if you will, or feel okay about consumption and our interactions with neoliberal hegemony, you know? And this isn't to say that we should be poverty fetishists and everybody should be, you know, living off of thrift store. Well, not thrift store. I get, you should probably go shop at the thrift store. It's way better than buying sweatshop clothes at Walmart. You know, if you're just thinking about being cheap. I buy all my clothes at cheap places, so I don't know. you know, who cares? It's clothing, you know. It's not going to save the world if you don't buy from Walmart. And I think that's where a lot of people get lost, and they kind of fall into a lifestyleism of being good stewards or communists, you know. They do these things simply because it's popular, I guess. the whole zero waste movement, which has now made the price of jars shoot up super high, and I don't get why some people are wasting their jars. I come from a family that saves all of their jars so that way you can fucking pickle shit once the garden comes in. You know what I mean? And so, to me, it's not lifestyleism. It's literally, that's how we ate, you know? That's how you eat. That's how you freaking actually survive in capitalist hegemony, being poor, you know, easier at least. I don't know how other people do it, but that's how we did it. And yeah, so...
I was going to say, I think to kind of break free of the lifestyleism... on the settler side of things, is if you are changing your lifestyle in ways that save you money and can save you time, then you should be ending up spending that money and time helping other people. I think that's kind of the change. It's lifestyleism if all you do is those
things.
The
lifestyle.
Yeah, just the lifestyle without the actual action. So, you know, I think that's if you're asking yourself that question of am I doing the right thing right now? Well, the first question is when was the last time you interacted with someone who would benefit from a bit of empowerment and help and stuff like that? And if it's just recently, then you're probably on a good track. And not yet, then looks like you're still working on getting on that good track.
Well, yeah, and then so then when it comes to communism, that lifestyle isn't there. I see a lot of people, you know, they collect all the books, you know, maybe they read them even. But when do you hear about their organizing, you know, in real life? That's what you always have to ask. It's cool and all if they, you know, read all this and could be a good armchair, but you can't really affect change and revolution if you're sitting on your ass at home reading more Karl Marx. You know, and I get it. I'm not one of those people who say don't read Karl Marx, but can we fucking stop focusing on him? He was wrong a lot. He made a lot of guesses and they were very wrong. You know, and it's a good analysis. That's why we read it. You know, we don't read him to have answers. We read him because it's a great way to learn how to think about the world. And because of that, you have great theorists that came after him, like Lenin, who actually affected revolution in his country, or Rosa Luxemburg, who used to shit on Lenin. You know, but she was, you know, given her circumstances, Nazi Germany's one hell of a fucking fight. And especially when the frickin' Bernsteins are selling you out, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, like social democrats, is that what they are? The Bernstein crowd?
Yeah, yeah, second international.
Okay, second international. But anyway, frickin', I think that decolonization is really, like, a better, you know, base for your analysis. Like, if you take decolonization and then put it into a Marxist lens, that's where you want to go, you know, when you're thinking about how can I help people. Because then you get things like, empowering people, like you were saying, like helping them help themselves is better than paternalizing them, which is often what charity does. You know, it's very, like, I don't know if you've ever been to, like, the Salvation Army, but, like, that's one hell of a place. They're like, yeah, give us money so we can fund freaking internment camps for gay people. Like, that's not okay.
Well, there's always a hook, right? I mean, in regards to charity, I think charity will always not be the best way to go forward, obviously, because what it does is it still creates a dependent relationship. And you're never going to get through anything if you can only create these dependent relationships, in the sense that will always have an imbalance between the parties that are interacting with each other. So I think that is the point, is it is not giving to the poor that we are supposed to do. It is empowering people who are in need. And when they are empowered, then they have the time and the space to make effective decisions for themselves.
That is, yeah, I mean, you couldn't have said it better, really.
There are a lot of people who I feel like they could just reach out to anyone. And, how would a revolution get started in those kinds of places? I think this is a good episode for those sorts of people, because it's going to teach you that, well, then if you are the only quote-unquote one, then you haven't really looked hard enough, I don't think. Because if you start looking around, you start talking to other people, remember, you're not here to proselytize communism. You're here to help other people, and then they will go on to help other people. And a people's movement will form. And if you are a principled communist and you have those understandings, then you can help with all of the things happening, and at least provide some insight, perhaps. But the number one thing you need to be doing is support.
Well, so, I mean, that we kind of get into it. Educate is what you need to be doing. If you're only supporting, then you fall into, like, a Taylorism, and you kind of hope that the people find the right way, which, you know, we end up having, like, bastardizations like Pol Pot of communism. So there has to be some theoretical basis for it. But if you're the only one reading theory, who cares? You know, not everybody needs to be reading theory, but what you need to be doing is, like, hey, I have a good idea, you know, and start, you know, showcasing the good ideas that communist theory comes up with, and fucking you can, or anarchist theory. I mean, like, you take from all the left, right? But whatever works, you know, for where you're at, that's what you should be doing. And with whoever there is, you don't have to join some organization, but you can have a coalition. You can help them still. You know, like, I'm a member of TRN. I'm not going to join some, like, liberal organization where I'm at. Because, I moved to a bigger town now, away from the ethnostate. not really away from it, but further away from where I was at. And, the only real organization is, like, a, you know, milquetoast liberal group that, well, not even, maybe they're, like, social democrats, you know, they're not really trying to overthrow capitalism violently. That's what I want.
It's not on their clipboard of priorities.
And so, what we do is, you know, you can use the Red Deal. That's what Red Nation does, is we use the Red Deal to organize externally, you know, with other people. It's a, you know, it's a pretty basic platform. I mean, it's revolutionary compared to anything fucking the Democrats put out, but I feel like it's very palatable to more people. But I don't think I have the right answers, really. I just, you know, have some ideas that I improve every day by analyzing and engaging with my material conditions. And what I think happens all too often is that people become anarchists because cellular actions are essential to a horizontalist structure like that. And so if you don't feel like you have power, you fall to individual action, because that's all you can do. I'm even telling you to fall to some individual action, you know? But this individualist approach will often fall into some sort of, you know, liberalism, where you give words to these causes, but you don't do anything about it. And so
absolutely. Yeah. Sorry. That just rung true so well, is that you fall into the frameworks of liberalism by acting alone.
Exactly. But it can also, you know, engage in revolutionary potential when you do stuff like, maybe you're the only person going around giving clothes, like collecting clothes from people. Ooh, my upstairs neighbor is jumping. But maybe you're like the only person going around like giving out food to homeless people. That's a great start. That's a great, like, I don't know if you're in a rural area with a lot of homeless people. Usually they live out in tents in the woods, you know, like walk into town. I had a friend who, he actually ended up dying. We went out there and found him. It was kind of sad, because I had just spoken to him, like, a week prior, and he said he was going to be moving. You know, that's just, like, one thing you could do is just start talking to the people who are clearly downtrodden in your town. Like, that in itself would make them happier, and you could even maybe empower them to change their life and, you know, whatever. Maybe they can actually get out of that funk. But chances are, you know, it's going to take a lot of hard work, and it's an uphill battle, especially by yourself. So, you know, as soon as you get a friend who's down to help, you know, like, that's a great start. Get your friends in on it. You know, that's where I would start, at least. And if your friends aren't into, you know, helping people, maybe you should reconsider who your friends are. But that's just like a... I'm not going to tell you how to live your life.
Yeah. Yeah, the more you can acknowledge another human being's humanity, I mean, the better their, like, the better their outlook is going to become. So, yeah, even sometimes just getting into a conversation can really mean a lot. And I like that. I like that idea.
And so, like, on the opposite side, you have the Demcent structure of a Marxist-Leninist organization. And that often results in theorizing the next struggle in its optics, you know, rather than engaging in the actual hard work. And if you don't engage in that hard work, you never learn new lessons and improve on your theory and positions as an organization, you know. And I think that the problem is exactly that. We separate the two into their own groups, and we start factionalizing ourselves as the left. You know, I personally see myself as a scientific socialist for a reason. And that reason is I do not see one group as more correct than the other. I think most analysis are applicable in a circumstantial basis, like, you know, take it case by case. And I bet you anarchist ideas will probably be good in certain situations. You know what I mean? And so why should we limit ourselves to one tendency? You know, why limit ourselves to one tendency's tendencies?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to suggest a big tent party, but I don't think we are ready for revolution. And until we are at that point, the vanguard and cadre cannot limit themselves to one sect. You know, there needs to be coalitions. There needs to be an intelligentsia that springs forth that can actually theorize this stuff. I mean, you have, like, attempts at it, but you get, like, Marxist Center and stuff like that. And what happens every time? There's always a mess. There's always some sort of mess that happens. And freaking things fall apart all the time with wrecking behavior. And we need to make a unified point to stand on. You know, it can't be enough to be against capitalism. We have to be for something else. We have to be for something on top of that. You know, of course we're against capitalism, but what else is there? You know, is that all you're going to say? Because you can blame everything on capitalism, but nobody's going to take you seriously because you can't articulate what's actually affecting them.
No, that's a good point. And I think that I've been using this analogy too often, but the online forumming and the over tendencyifying of our discourse is like there is a car driving straight toward a brick wall. We are in the end stage of capitalism here. This is the extinction race now. And as this car, this hypothetical car, is driving towards a brick wall, it seems all we on the left can do is argue about who's going to be in the front seat. And I mean, on our notes here, you just write like, oh, I want to die first. And it's like, well, if we continue doing this, it's exactly. Like, you know, it's like scolding the person next to you during a plane crash or something like that, instead of just like trying to figure out what exactly
you are. You hyperventilating right now? That is ridiculous.
yeah, exactly. So just if I could really quick, you know, you say, you know, scientific socialism and stuff like that. And I think sometimes someone might mistake this for the anti-political science discourse, right? There's always these people, especially on liberals. Yeah, oh yeah, they say, well, science is apolitical.
What? Like, science is completely political.
Well, and that's the thing, is when we look at scientific socialism, it's how we scientifically use trial and error, experimentation, and a very clear-eyed focus on the data that we get from the things we do to turn it into theory, right?
Well, and like when you're reading a peer review journal, you should look at where the people got their funding, right? Exactly. So in the case of a socialist revolution, you should look at where the ideas are coming from, right? You should do some sort of investigation on where the foundations of that research is coming from. Is it coming from a book, or is it coming from being on the streets helping people? Yeah. You know?
And we don't have a foothold at all anywhere. In the sort of the imperial metropole here, right? Like there are small footholds in parts of the world. There's national footholds in some cases, right? But until we have an established foothold, it's kind of like grab onto whatever branch you can. And I think the more we get with each other, the more we talk with each other, it's not like I am the same person I was 5 years ago, and I don't expect myself to be like the same person in 5 years. And so the people you meet up with, the people you link up with, are going to change you. You're going to change them. But if your drive is towards a revolutionary understanding of the material conditions and helping people to get to that point, then I think you can know you're on a good track, because you'll be with those people, you'll be doing those things together. And yeah, you're going to interact with anarchists, Trotskyists, Marxist-Leninists, Democrats.
Well, hold on. We don't have to interact with Trotskyists.
Right. And there's always the joke about that, but sometimes that's all you got.
No, I just don't want to sell newspapers for them. Okay.
No, I don't either.
You don't need to do that for them. Okay. That's not helping them. That's just
tell them to bring more cabbage and less newspaper, right?
More cabbage, less newspaper. Exactly.
Yeah. More cabbage, less newspaper. Like, come on.
I like that. More cabbage.
You know what? For every 3 heads of cabbage, you can turn into like a really good soup, or maybe some cabbage rolls or something like that. We will let you distribute 30 newspapers. How's that?
But no, as you were saying, though, I think that kind of encapsulates, like, you know, how people, you change, you're constantly developing, or at least you should be, right?
Yeah.
At least dialectically speaking. By yourself, well, like, it's imperative that you read or listen or talk to somebody, that, like, eventually will radicalize you. And I think this proletarian life sort of encapsulates that phenomenon pretty well. Mm-hmm. Where, like, you know, there's a communist journey, if you will, that can serve to kind of guideline somebody how they should study. And a lot of people, it's like State and Rev, or, you know, A Conquest of Bread, or Settlers. And to me, those are kind of like they 100% encapsulate the online left and, like, the primary factions there are, and that's anarchism, Marxism, Leninism, and, like, Maoism or MLM, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. this factionalism is what causes the constant infighting, and all too often it's because we are limiting our studies and not engaging in enough on the groundwork. You know, online is what I'm talking about. Like, you see these people arguing on Twitter about this. And it's like, yes, those are all good books. I have all 3 of them right next to me right now. I've read them all because I wanted to understand the other points of views and at least do that, you know, at least do that. Maybe there's a podcast. Listen to the podcast if you don't want to read it because you're so uptight about it. But, like, we can't be sitting here being picky about who we organize with because there's not enough people who are willing to organize. That's the problem. There's a numbers problem going on here. And protests are important, but in no way is it the solution, you know. And all too, like, I was just at a protest 2 days ago or something like that. And all too often, people forget why revolutions were able to succeed. And that's the people's support of the revolution. Legitimization amongst the people. The people will be your mountains, and that's where your success will come from. We as revolutionaries are the ones who must educate and do the hard work because the people are there to be our mountains and to provide for us and to support and give us morale, and that will keep us going, you know? Yeah.
The more we show up, the more they're going to believe us, too.
Yeah, exactly. You can't just sit there and say, this is what you want to do, and then only go every once in a while. If you only go to the freaking, like, okay, say there's a sovereignty camp right near you for some reason, and you only go there maybe, like, I don't know, every 3 months. Are you really helping? Are you just sort of going there, like, to say that you went? Yeah. Is this, like, a step on your resume of communism? Basically. The resume of communism. That's a sentence. But that's essentially what you're doing if you're sitting there trying to get these bona fides that are like, oh, I was here and here and here. Who gives a fuck? Just keep doing it. Why do you need to talk about it? You know, well, here I am on a podcast.
Yeah, but also, like you just said, you were at a protest. You know, you've talked to me about the fact that you're going to be literally crossing the country to learn more about the American Indian movement. You're a member of an actual revolutionary party that is actually doing real work, right? You, when you are down where you're at, you know, you're out helping out the folks at Camp Miluzahan and you know, seeing the people that are important to you and stuff like that and working with them. So yeah, you're on a podcast, but you know, I mean, at least you put your money where your mouth is.
Right. That's what, like, I guess, like, that's why I don't feel bad about doing this podcast because, you know, I do enough in real life compared to most people, I guess. And even then it's like, I feel like I'm lacking, you know, I know where my failings are and I try to be honest about them, you know, but when you're alone in a small rural city, you don't feel empowered to stand on the road with a sign. You know, if you're the only person protesting, it's pretty awkward. But maybe if you did, you might get some sort of support, you know, like we had a small group. It wasn't that big of a turnout. But then you had the right wing counter protesters across the street. There's like three of them. And one's like a 40-year-old man playing ABBA, literally was playing ABBA to try to drown us out.
Should have brought your doll bottoms.
Who should have? So I find that it's... sorry. Just remembering the ABBA is too funny. I find that it is while working that what you say actually holds meaning, you know? And because all too often that becomes our only community, you know? Like, I'm talking at your job. Well, even at protest, sure. But your coworkers tend to respect your opinion if you prove that your opinion deserves to be respected, is essentially it. Like, a lot of people, and, like, you know, that has some weird connotations to it, but that's society, whatever, you know, that's what you're working with. often this, like, I think everybody's opinion should be respected right away, but, well, not even, that's a lie. I don't think that. There's some people who are Nazis, for one. So I guess that's not true. Like, everybody should earn their respect, but, like, I think there should be some basic human decency where you'll hear out people as long as they're not openly racist, you know? Yeah. And often this comes from, but oftentimes, like, the respect comes from meeting them where they are, you know, like, instead of going, oh, we should form a union, just, my job fucking sucks, and just talk to them about that, you know? Who doesn't talk about their job sucking? Rather than immediately trying to suggest, you know, leftist organizings, talk to them like they're a person and not a political project.
Yeah. And I hope that you're the person. Stop thinking that you're the person who's going to be, you know, like that picture of Lenin up on the podium there, and he's like talking to all of these people. And I think we get lost in this idea that we might have to be that person. I think the number one thing you have to realize is, statistically speaking, it's not going to happen. So stop caring about it. And who knows? Maybe you empowering someone, you might empower the person who is going to be the one up on that podium.
Right? Exactly.
Think about it more that way. Right. You can help empower people to get into the mind frame that they can start leading their fellow proletariat together. Right. And if that's all you end up being, and you know, you're not even remembered, like, who fucking cares? Right. If you've helped people's material conditions, then you can die happy.
Like, exactly. I mean, like, you shouldn't want, like, I want to see communism. Right. But I don't think I'm going to.
I'm pretty sure it ain't gonna happen.
Everything I'm doing now, I'm never gonna get to see the full fruits of my labor. You know, I will never get to see that, and that is why I do what I do, because I believe everybody should get to see the full fruits of their labor, you know, in their life. And it's emotional to me to think about that. Like, that's just like the state of the left.
You might not see the transition, but you might, but you're gonna see revolution. You're definitely going to, because the first place it happens is in you.
Well, okay.
Well, you've got to change your life, right? And that takes work.
Sure.
And it's hard. And I'm currently going through it right now. It's fucking difficult.
See in the world. Who is that? Sure. Is that Dr. Seuss? Oh, no.
No, that's Gandhi.
Oh, is that Gandhi? Okay. Yeah. Oh, I don't think that's any better.
No.
He was really racist.
Also, if like, you didn't super know that. Problematic. Super problematic.
Oh, did he hear that?
Yeah, let's
yeah, keep we'll on, leave keep that on, there. I just remembered some shit. Oh my god, look up Gandhi. If you don't know who Gandhi is, I don't know why you're here.
Nehru did a lot more to unite India than Gandhi did.
So, sure, you should include some sort of leftist politics when you talk, but if you sit there and try to convert them to your brand of leftism, or, you know, insert like a Christian analogy here, you've already alienated yourself from the working class. I mean, literally look at how Christians are seen in society now. You know, like, they're not jobs, and everybody's realizing it. Like, yeah. As soon as you start dancing, and I'm not saying all, like, the agnostic Christians are pretty cool people usually. People who aren't into organized religion are usually pretty cool people. You know, as soon as, like, you start making hierarchical structures that, for some reason, funnel money all the way to some guy at the top, for no reason at all besides that he runs the church, the church organization. Like, as a church, why don't you just buy houses, pay the taxes with all that money, and, like, let them live there and, like, provide food for them? And yeah, I don't know.
That's the story of the Vatican, right? It got built because they weren't doing that. Like, all the money that could have gone to actually physically helping people went to building a place that I just was so tempted to bounce a big bouncy ball around in.
Did you actually go to the Vatican?
Yeah, I've been to that again.
I would love to throw a bouncy ball.
Oh, yeah, it's like this huge marble.
Off the Sistine Chapel. Like,
no, in there, it's actually smaller than you'd think.
Really?
The Sistine Chapel is. You want the St. Peter's Basilica. The Basilica is off the hook. Like, I would want to go way to the top and, like, just drop, like, a million bouncy balls.
Well, I just want to ruin a famous painting.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's tons of them all over the place.
I hate the Catholic Church, though.
I feel that. But
colonization was a motherfucker.
Yeah. Well, and we have to watch sometimes, because I think some of the language used, especially on kind of the more online left, is it gets religiosity kind of sort of saturated a bit, in the sense that, like, what I just said, like, the revolution starts in yourself, and in a sort of idealistic sense,
this is, you can say that about chicken. This is chicken noodle soup for the soul now.
for the radical soul, right? No,
for the radical soul. There we go.
When that's I say the book. Revolution comes
I'm
from
writing within it this summer. Yeah. It's a self-help book.
Yeah, when revolution comes from inside, it isn't that, like, you, like, feel better. It's like, no, you're exhausted because you're doing more work. like, and you're doing more meaningful, practical work that is actually helping people and helping you learn and grow. Like, that's how you measure it. It's not just like, I can argue better on Discord or Twitter now. It's that, like, oh wow, I haven't been on Discord or Twitter forever because I'm busy making soup. Like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, the revolution starts from inside.
Is, honestly, though,
have to change your life.
Like, I don't get how people are so on Twitter. I get all my Twitter information from other people. I do not go on there myself. You can look at my Twitter. There's only one Twitter. It's Bans Island. That's my personal Twitter as well as the show's. And they always say don't do that because people always fuck it up. I don't, because I don't go on Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really do much on the Little Red Schoolhouse Twitter. That's John's realm a lot more, and I feel bad about that. Because I kind of...
Do you have a personal Twitter?
I have a personal Twitter, but it's completely divorced from anything.
See, and I'm really... Nick helps curate my Twitter experience. I get to see all the shit that happens because people like to fucking hate him.
Super fair enough.
I'm like, I don't know why people are like this, but okay.
Yeah. So maybe we can maybe say a little bit about our journey then to get to communism.
Our journey to the center of communism?
Sure. I mean, wherever the center might be. I mean,
no, it's a center of the earth.
Yeah. Joke. I get it. Sorry, I'm all serious now because I'm trying to
levity. I'm the worst. Yeah. I can't ever be serious.
It's good. Because that's the other thing is we can't take a lot of this seriously because, I mean, if you do, you just crumble, right? Like, I've been learning
about... It's a depressing world out there.
Yeah, it's hard to see. Like, you and I to be pre-call, right? You and I touched base earlier, and I was driving around because there was a person who I thought might have, like, been in
died on the bench. Like, what a life to be living where you're like, oh, there's a guy on the bench. I hope he's not dead, is your first thought.
Yeah,
so like, I hate this country that's something we have to worry about. I've seen a guy frozen on the bench while going to... I was taking the bus to work one day. I saw a dude dead on the bench, and I didn't know it. That's awful.
It happens all too often in the wintertime where I am.
Exactly. It gets cold here too. And like, it was like 4 years ago or something like that, like 18 people froze in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. That's terrifying. That's not okay. And like, thank God somebody like you in Alberta, I can only imagine how fucking cold it's there.
That's not so bad anymore, but yeah.
Well, yeah, I hope not. Like all the snow's gone here, but it's been a warm year for some reason.
It snowed yesterday, so first day of spring.
That's awful. It was like 50 degrees yesterday here, and I was like, yes. That's warm.
But I think...
I don't know if anybody heard that and thought that was cold, but that's really warm here. 50 degrees is great.
It depends on what you're used to. And I think that's where it comes down to, right? Especially when we see unhoused people, when we see people who are living a precarious lifestyle, who are trying to manage an addiction, all these sorts of things. It's what you can get used to. And you know what? I bet you a year ago this time, I might have driven right by and not said any thought anything or anything whatsoever, right? And that's, again, an indication that your journey is still going. Like, how did I get to the journey to the center of communism? I guess is more like, what's the journey currently looking like? And how far...
I'm not there yet.
You're never going to be there, right? No one ever gets there.
Since we're talking about the journey, mine sort of like is, I'm going to talk about the books, right? And try to interlude my life and how it was effective, I guess, or like maybe you should ask how like it applies to my personal life. I guess, I don't know. I don't know what the best way to do this, but I'm going to talk about the books a lot rather than my actual material conditions. Because I'm a hypocrite.
Well, I'll pipe in from time to time, but I think this needs to be a story about you because this is how we understand decolonization, by understanding the story of people who live colonized lives.
And so, well, one of the perfect examples of colonization is school. The institution of school is a fundamental stripping of Indianhood. You can look at the boarding school as one of the easiest examples, but like personally, you know, they wouldn't even say my real name. I was forced to have a nickname that now I use it all the time, but I freaking you know, I basically just didn't have a name that was mine. I would say my name once, and then everybody would be like, oh, and laugh, because it's, or when a step, like a step teacher, substitute teacher.
That's like their new name.
Step teacher.
I'm a step teacher. That's like a teacher that takes over halfway through the year. I've been that teacher before, and I definitely felt like a step teacher. Yeah, no, I inherited a disaster one year, and it was loads of fun. We had great time.
But, like, you know, when you are dehumanized like that, like, it's really dehumanizing to not be called your name, you know, and then to, like, have every time a substitute teacher comes in, have to, like, hear them go, Mr., your last name? I don't want to butcher your name, so is there something easier I can call you? It's like, I'd rather you butcher my name.
Thanks for the ultimatum, jackass.
Yeah.
I butcher your name or I call you Fred. Like, there's no in between.
What's worse is Fred is a name that I've been called by people before, and my name is nowhere close to Fred.
Oy vey.
And that's, like, why we played that song Drums, because, like, in there, it says, and I call when they call Billy, though I've got an Indian name. That song really resonates with me, like, too much. I like country, so I'm sorry for everybody. I forced you all to listen to that.
If it's the worst thing that happened to them all week, they had a good week.
Oh, that's true. That's a great song. So, So school was terrible for me, and I just hated it. I didn't like it. It didn't interest me. I was only ever... Well, like, back when I was in elementary school, they actually did teach us a lot about natives, but, like, it was, a white version of the stories. And so, like, you only really hear about, like, violence and, like, resistance. Not even... But they don't frame it as resistance, you know? They frame it as... Oh, Pontiac assaulted. I think it was like Fort Cadillac or something like that.
Detroit.
Oh, it was Detroit. I don't fucking
know. Yeah, he was waiting for Brock.
Okay.
Who was a British general?
There was like a bunch of different like cases like that in Michigan. Like, there's the famous like lacrosse game that they throw the ball into the fort. And can we get it? And the white people just let him in.
It was the classic over the fence game. Like, I thought that was the best. Like, hey, our ball landed in there and your dog keeps barking at us. Do you think we could come in and get it? And they'd be like, yeah, just shut the gate when you're done. And they just take over the fort.
It's really good. And so, like, that's all you ever hear about. And it's really sad that, you know, you don't get any in-depth looks at it. Because if people learned about, like, Tecumseh and, you know, Poundmaker and stuff like that, you would... I think we would all be inspired to have created socialism long ago. Yeah.
To think that Tecumseh and Pontiac in their own times, and I might even mixed up the story there. I forget now if it's Tecumseh or Pontiac who was waiting for Brock at Detroit, because it's like history repeats.
It's Pontiac, right? I think.
But they had standing armies. Like, they had full
Tecumseh,
standing armies.
I don't think Tecumseh was in Detroit. Like, he was along the Mississippi making the huge fucking alliance that... Well, and then his brother jumped the gun. Which was sad.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you're pissed, you know.
you see an opportunity to finally different. Like, you always think about, like, those Bugs Bunny episodes when they're, like, funnily shooting at indigenous people attacking the fort, and it's got this idea of, like, they're attacking the frontier from these marauding, you know, these marauders, for interlopers, that sort of stuff, when actually what it is the marauders have built a fort and the home front, the indigenous people, are trying to take their house back. They're trying to take their home back. This is you are on the side of the evil one, Bugs, and it's funny how, like, then he can go on and, like, tally them off and then erase half of a tally because one's quote unquote a half breed. Seriously, look it up. Have you ever heard that racism? Like, the fucking crazy racism that comes out of Looney Tunes? It's absolutely bonkers.
That's,
they did it twice.
Crazy.
Yeah, like pardon this, total content warning, everybody. I need to just say this right off the bat here, because I'm going to be doing some misrepresentation of names and everything, but this is literally quoting it off where Bugs Bunny is shooting over the wall of a fort, right, from his, like, parapet at, like, warriors, indigenous warriors, and he's shouting one little, two little, three little Indians, and he keeps tallying, and he gets to like six, and he goes, oh wait, no, that one was a half breed, and he erases half of the tally and then continues on his little stupid song. And then it happens again when Tweety Bird and the grandma are doing it, and it's the exact same song that they sing, and it's like, I can't watch Space Jam anymore. Like, it ruined.
Well,
like,
have you ever, Space Jam
for me.
It's really common to hear that. I've heard that song a lot in, like, the Dakota area. Like, it's really common. But I've never seen it in Looney Tunes.
But it was like from the 60s too. Like, sure. It was, and they've never acknowledged it, as far as I understand. I mean, if they did, it's not very public. It's not very well known, so they might want to be
able to brush that one under the rug.
Well, that's the thing, and then everyone's like, "Oh, cancel culture is bullshit. They're getting rid of Mr. Potato Head because of the name and all this sort of stuff." And it's like, that is 100% a distraction from the actual social engineering that took place to get us into an area where we can complain about Pepe Le Pew and stuff like that. Like, it's
yeah, like we're overcoming a lot of fucking detrimental fucking.
Yeah, and to trivialize it by being like, oh, well, people just can't get over their problems. It's like, well, no, they were making fun of actual things that were traumatizing people at the time. Like, they were literally planting it in cartoons. And
genocide's funny.
Yeah, and making it, like, funny. Like, it's absolute insanity.
Like, when I laugh about it, it's a traumatic laugh. It's me trying to cope, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and they laugh at it, literally they think it's funny.
Yeah, well, there was a YouTube comment, actually, when I was looking at it, where it literally said, like, I'm from the res, and I found this funny. And it's like, A, that could be a troll, and B, even if it was a person from a reservation who watched it, they could have thought it was funny, but I mean, that doesn't justify humor. The idea
is kind of funny, but it's not like, you know, it's once you actually contextualize it, you're like, oh, that's actually really fucked up. Yeah. Maybe we shouldn't be showing children this.
Yeah, you know, it's a super dark irony.
Like, on the res, you'll find a lot of people that there's a lot of dark humor out there. They think that kind of stuff's really funny, sure. But the reason they think it's funny is because it's like, well, you know, we live this kind of life. We have to laugh at something, you know. And a lot of times,
crying.
Yeah, a lot of times the only real thing you have is just racist jokes. I mean, you'll find a lot, like, you hear that all the time from people. Is like, oh, yeah, the Latinos are really, they have a lot of racist jokes there, too. It's very common for people to be racist when they're, you know, just normal people, I guess. Like, if you're not actively learning political theory and stuff like that, most normal people like racist jokes. I'm sorry. That's just true. Well,
there's an entire Broadway musical called Avenue Q that talks about everyone's a little bit racist sometimes, which is, like, totally just the liberal acquiescence, right? It's that's reinforcing, like, oh, well, you know, you're going to get some eggs. You know, when you crack an egg, you're going to get some shell in your food every now and again. You just have to get used to it. It's like, well, no, actually.
You don't have to get used to it.
People are conditioned to be a little bit racist sometimes, you know. And yes, people don't always go off committing hate crimes or anything like that. But they certainly can silo themselves and shut themselves off from hate crimes. Like, you think about all the shit that's happened around the world. And, like, especially, like, even think about the now disappearing Iraq war, right? You got me into that series Blowback.
Oh, have you been listening? It's pretty good.
I've been listening to it, but it's true just how memory hold it's been. Like, all of these hate crimes, all of these war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, all of those things happened and are still happening, actually, in that area, right? The what we call the Middle East, which is so just Western-centric, right? No, it's the Arabian Peninsula, the Levant, and most of the Horn of Africa, actually, where we're talking. And it's absolutely insane that yeah, like, most kids I talk to who I teach don't really know much about the Iraq war at all, other than it, like, lasted for a while and, like, some people died and South Park did a movie about it or something.
Wait, did they? Is that what the movie's about, is the Iraq war?
Well, no, Saddam's in it. He's in hell and he's, like, the devil's, like, partner kind of thing. Like,
well, I know partner. That in the TV show, that's a thing. I didn't know that the movie had that.
I think it's in the movie. I don't watch it enough. I went to the movie when I was, like, 17 years old, and that's the only time I've seen it. So I am dealing with some like, longer than I've been alive for longer than I was 17 years old since then. So I haven't seen episode, but that's what I remember.
Okay, so now that we got off on that little tangent.
So you finished school. You finished school. Where are we at?
So, like, yeah, I hate school, right? And I didn't do well because I didn't care enough because it wasn't anything that actually was applicable to me. You know, I'm being taught English and whatever. Like, that's cool. I should be able to speak good English, right? But, like, speak English well. I don't. You know, I got all that schooling and I still don't. I have, like, the idioms of just the res where it's just, you say things very broken English on accident, I guess, and I don't realize it. And I just don't care. Like, I don't. Who gives a fuck? As long as you understand me, you know, and you should see me type. God. Like, I literally get, like, this is my job is to do podcasts right now. And, like, while I research and freaking, like, I type all the time and I'm terrible at it. You'd think I would be better for the amount of schooling I had that focused on it, but I'm not. And I don't think that's my fault. I think it's more like I was raised with, like, in a Lakota household, being, like, spoken to in Lakota, so that way I would actually learn and speak Lakota myself, you know, and I would go on to forget, you know, like, I was barely speaking it probably at all, and freaking what I did know, I forget, you know. And so now I'm relearning it as a fucking, you know, in my 20s now. I don't know, when did I start, like, actually trying to learn? Maybe 19, I started to try to learn again, and, like, it's slow. And when you don't have a teacher, you're literally teaching yourself, and there's no Duolingo for Lakota Yuppie, so I'm a little fucked. And so, like, the only thing that really caught my interest was English. Though, I liked writing the essays. I was good at it. It took me like 15 minutes for something I didn't give a shit about. And then if it was something I actually cared about, like if we got to do like a book report or something on a book we liked or chose to read, then bam. I fucking loved that shit. And that's what exactly what happened was with my English teacher my freshman year suggested John Stewart's book. Couldn't tell you what it's called.
And that America the Book or something like that.
Something like that. And that was the very first political essay I wrote. And from there, I read the Communist Manifesto and concluded that it was utopian because it said it was. You know, like it's in the word, it's in there. So you automatically, because logic, you can't have utopia. So fucking out there. From there, like it was just sort of robotic almost, and I kind of feel like that's why I was identifying as a libertarian. Like it was more of like a left version of a libertarian, but like if you know who Russell Means is, like my family, like he's my family, and all my family is very much politically aligned with it, but kind of. And so like my grandma's more left, like I was, but like they're all pretty. Right wing, if you will. It's very awful. My aunt, I'm not going to say her name. My aunt, though, she was like running a Trump campaign in her city or something like that. I was like, oh God, shoot me. Talk about an apple. Anyway, it's red on the outside, white on the inside. From there, I read, I was homeless. I, like, left school 14. Well, we moved to Detroit. And I said, fuck that. Got in a fight with my dad. Moved out. Started working at McDonald's and was a drug dealer. 14. Super good. And when that lifestyle finally caught up with me, you know, I was hungry, cold. And, you know, I didn't have any help. And sort of ego death occurred, and I began to question a lot of things in my life. You know, most of all, why do people go hungry in the richest nation in the world? Why are people homeless? You know, I realized that I was, you know, manipulated into believing that it was a Christian country. And then when you look at the other Christian countries like South Africa and stuff, you see they're doing the same horrible fucking things. You know, you look at the histories and you see, holy shit. We're fucking horrible people. As an American, you should absolutely think this country is horrible. Like, sure, there might be good things in it, but overall, the political agenda of this country is not Christian by any means. And if it is, if this is Christianity, what the fuck is the Bible? Because it did not say we should do this.
Yeah, read the Bible. Anytime I ever hear of a rich Christian, I always think of the saying, like in the book itself, it says it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Like, I don't know how much more simple you can say it, but I think that again is where we get a little bit of a mirror and echo in the sense that we know that there are no ethical billionaires. There's no way that you can make that much money without having blood on your hands.
Yeah, and almost all the time, like, you track the money back, and it's, like, blood money. It's always blood money. It's terrifying how much blood money there is. Like, Microsoft has slaves involved in its supply chain. Apple, freaking everybody has slaves involved in their, like, literal slaves involved in their supply chain. It's terrifying.
Well, and I was thinking about your age, and you're about the same age as the people, the young men I was teaching at. Or sorry, I'm going to start that one over.
Cut that one out.
Yeah, cut that one out. I can't say the name of the school because you'll find me in 3 seconds. anywho.
Hope you're ready to die.
Yeah. But anyway, so, you know, it reminds me, you know, you're about the same age as the young lads and fellas I taught back in the UK and have since managed to reconnect with a little bit here and there. And I think about how, you know, you're saying that you didn't spend as much time as me in school, and yet here you are the one teaching me. And I think that's another piece of this is you had your education
from the streets.
Well, no, it hit you in the face. Right?
No, like, yeah, 100%.
Someone like myself, I've just sort of obliquely come to understand all of this. And it is sort of this long journey because what took me close to 40 years took you close to 20. And I think right there is the perfect example of how when we can help people in need, they will come online fast. They will start working fast. They will start being able to manage themselves. And even if it just means their life's going to be a little bit better, like you started thinking some really, really important thoughts that I think just naturally led you in the direction of political activism by asking the questions you did. And it's not like everyone's going to every person in need is like some Manchurian candidate of radical
change. All they need is the secret code phrase.
Yeah, just... Give them some soup, you know, reliably for the next 3 months, and then they'll suddenly like be on that podium, like I was saying. More so, it's just you're going to make their life better, and making another person's life better is easily the most human thing you can do. And if that person is anything near to what your story that you're saying so far is, then that person might be able to make some real change, and wouldn't that be great?
Well, anyway, I always say I was born the right race, and I use scare quotes when I say that because, you know, it's basically because I'm native and I was from Pine Ridge that I was just basically naturally inclined to go into politics. Plus, my family was involved in politics, like I said, Russell Means. unfortunately, not where I'm at with politics, and I hate being able to say that, but, like, you know, like, I don't... Russell is a whole case that people don't understand. And so it's very confusing to explain to people because, like, you know, the natural inclination, like, is so natural to me that I just feel like everybody will just become communists if I give them enough education. And that's just not the truth. You know, a lot of people just don't want to be involved in politics because, like... it's extra stress, you know. Why would you stress yourself out more? I mean, a lot of people don't want to be, like, aware of world politics. And, you know, why would you do that? You're literally just stressing yourself out even more. In the United States, like, there's already enough fucked up news. Why add on to it with the rest of the world's problems, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so, like, I've always been aware of these, like, gruesome truths of genocide and, you know, pointless wars against native people of other countries, you know, like, that is just foundational to my upbringing is being aware of this stuff and always being reminded by, you know, looking around and seeing a classroom full of white kids instead of other natives. You know, and I lived near other natives. That's the sad part, was there was more white kids than natives.
Well, turn it around and be like, you know, imagine in some French classroom in France and someone comes in and nobody is of French nationality, let's just say, or French speaking. And they're like, oh, hello.
They're all Germans.
I'm not going to say your name. Yeah, we'll actually have a, I'm not going to say your name kind of thing. Like it's a bit of a flimsy connection too, because I do think that we end up getting into this kind of every race needs to speak its own language. And I have to say that like, the relationships that I've begun to understand, especially when it comes to, in a more decolonial phrase, is we need to also destroy the nation. We need to destroy our concepts of these artificial economic borders that we place on things, because it's
destroy the state. I wouldn't say we need to destroy the nation. I think you're getting into an anarchist.
I'm using the wrong words.
Yeah.
I'm using the wrong words. You're right. So maybe that's the thing, is making sure that we understand the difference between state and nation, and the idea that
the national question by Stalin. Read it.
But I think what I'm saying is that the Western European capitalist understanding of nation is not sufficient.
It's synonymous with state, and it's devoid of culture usually.
And that's why I'm screwing up the analogy too, is I am currently decolonizing my vocabulary and my brain, and it's a mess up there, I tell you.
Well, so that's the thing, is like those words specifically, like when we're talking about nation and stuff, what is a nation? You know, a lot of like people don't even understand that. Maybe that's our next episode. What is a nation? You know, yeah. That's actually a great place to go. Let's do that. Write it down.
Hey, get in touch with us on either Bands of Turtle Island or on Little Red Schoolhouse if you think that is a thing you want to do or want us to do.
Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look. Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, all I ever had, redemption songs, these songs of freedom, songs of freedom.